the only way to stop this spreading is to do the mastery, to stop the cancer.
Their behavior echoes, which is going to profit of your suffering and ignore basic dignity, and no one will care.
The idea that the conditions within detention centers have long propelled some people to withdraw their claims is certainly something that immigration advocates and lawyers and detainees themselves have been raising concerns about for quite some time.
Oftentimes when we're having these conversations in our smaller, more suburban towns, people think it's not our problem. People think racism doesn't live here. They think it's a big city issue.
From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Network and radio affiliates. I'm Scott Baba. In today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy, Kat Brooks takes a look at the challenges facing San Quentin Prison, where over a third of inmates have contracted COVID-19. Brian Edwards Tiegert speaks to voices both inside and outside ICE detention centers about the agency's response to the ongoing pandemic. And Davey D. explores small-town America's response to Black Lives Matter. But first, the news.
I'm Eileen Alfandary with KPFA News headlines. The U.S. reported a record 60,000 new cases of COVID-19 in a single day as the runaway virus is overwhelming hospitals in the worst-hit states. Arizona, Florida, and South Carolina have the highest rate of new cases in the world over a seven-day period, according to a ranking by the New York Times. Louisiana, Alabama, Nevada, Mississippi, Texas, and Georgia are not far behind. California ranks behind them, 16th in the world, with 1.4 thousand cases per million residents. The U.S. is likely to top 3 million recorded cases later today, according to statistics compiled by Johns Hopkins University. Infectious disease specialist Dr. Anthony Fauci implicitly countered President Trump's emphasis on falling death rates from the virus as good news.
It's a false narrative to take comfort in a lower rate of death. There's so many other things that are very dangerous and bad about this virus. Don't get yourself into false complacency.
In a separate appearance, White House Coronavirus Response Coordinator Dr. Deborah Birx said no one really anticipated the amount of community spread now taking place among 18 to 35-year-olds. They've helped drive recent increases. Texas, California, Hawaii, Missouri, Montana, and Oklahoma set single-day records for new cases yesterday. The White House Coronavirus Task Force plans to hold a briefing. President Trump launched an all-out effort, pressing state and local officials to reopen schools in the fall. He argued some are keeping schools closed, not because of the risks from the coronavirus pandemic, but for political reasons.
I want to just say get open in the fall. We want your schools open. It's going to be a much better climate than it is right now. We're on the right side of things. Deborah, I think we can say that. A lot of work has been done. We understand what we're doing very, very well. But I noticed that today, and probably others are doing that. That's called the easy way out.
The president of the nation's largest education union said Trump is more interested in scoring points for the November election than in keeping students safe. Lily Eskelson Garcia is president of the National Education Association. She contradicted Trump's claim that children, quote, do extraordinarily well with COVID-19.
Little people can get sick. You have asthma, you've got bad allergies, and you're 6 years old. You could die if we do this wrong.
The U.S. Supreme Court sided with the Trump administration in its effort to allow more employers to opt out of providing no-cost birth control to women as required by the Affordable Care Act. In the opinion written by Justice Clarence Thomas, the High Court ruled 7-2 that the Trump administration acted properly when it allowed more employers who cite a religious or moral objection to opt out of covering birth control. As a result of the Obama-era health law, most employers must cover birth control as a preventive service at no charge to women in their insurance plans. The government had estimated that the rules changes would cause about 70,000 women and at most 126,000 to lose contraception coverage in 1 year. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg cited those numbers in her dissent. Justice Sonia Sotomayor also dissented. In a separate case, the court sided with two Catholic schools in a ruling that underscores that certain employees of religious schools, hospitals, and social service centers cannot sue for employment discrimination. The high court ruling in that case was also 7-2, with Justices Sotomayor and Ginsburg again dissenting.
Welcome to COVID, Race, and Democracy. First up, Philip Melendez was formerly incarcerated at San Quentin Prison and is currently program manager at Restore Justice, a nonprofit organization that works to reimagine the U.S. justice system. He spoke to Kat Brooks, co-host of Upfront, about the conditions at San Quentin Prison, where over the last month, over 1,400 inmates, more than a third of the incarcerated population, have been infected with COVID-19. They discussed an ongoing hunger strike at the prison, protesting what the prisoners say are inhumane conditions and the state's inadequate response to the pandemic.
There's some conflicting reports as to who is on a hunger strike and how many, but tell us what you know about the hunger strike so far.
Yeah, I've seen that the conflicting reports. I've seen that it was 20. I've heard that it was less. But one thing that we need to note when it comes to the hunger strikes is that you're not technically classified as a participant until you miss 9 consecutive meals. So, like, if we all stand in solidarity, like, hey, look, we're going on a hunger strike. There's 100 of us. Bam, right? We're all hunger striking. We missed 2 meals. The state doesn't even recognize it. So, you know, those numbers can fluctuate based on what's classified as a specifically classified as a hunger strike.
And do you know how many are participating?
Well, from the friends of mine that I've heard from inside, it was somewhere around 20 in the Badger section. Sadly, it's not more widespread. It's probably really hard for the folks inside to do it. I get it. I know, you know, the conditions are deplorable, but what you're doing is you're risking your body, you're risking your life to make a statement, and it's not even 100%. You're not even 100% sure that statement is going to make it out. Fortunately, you know, we get to go on up front on KPFA, but you know, the reports of the hunger strikes are underreported, honestly, in the media, I would say.
And talk a little bit about the Badger section that you mentioned, that this is where people who are tested positive for COVID-19 are being placed. Correct?
Yeah. Originally that was the part of the reception center. And so reception center is basically when you're first coming to prison, before you're formally classified and get whatever level designation you're going to be designated as, you'll go there. And so when you come for a reception, that's where you'll stay. But what happened recently is that, you know, with that botched transfer, that terrible transfer that they did, they put people in there to try to quarantine them at first. And so now that's just become a huge outbreak place. All the buildings have shifted, or not shifted, but you know, some were designated as reception, but then some have been redesignated as COVID overflow, like the adjustment center, which was the hole for the death row population, for the kind of row people, that had been repurposed into a COVID response or COVID placement for people who test positive. And so Badger has become a very huge petri dish. And, you know, it started with that transfer.
And in addition to the Badger section, it's my understanding that there are also tents where people are being treated. Do you know where people are being placed and treated for COVID-19 inside?
Yeah, so, well, inside, I would say that the prison itself is definitely not set up to hold or house people with serious medical conditions. I don't think any prison has been designed as a hospital. They're designed as prisons, so they function as such. So when it comes to major illnesses, you are most likely transferred to an outside hospital. But I think there's been overflow in the county of Marin, and so based on that, what they did in response is create those tents. And so basically what those tents are, They're ventilated, outside tents, triage type of places, COVID positive bunkers, so to speak. And yeah, they're in the middle of the yard. And, you know, that's definitely indicative of what's really going on, the inability to provide the constitutional medical care that these people deserve.
And we've talked about it on the show before, but can you talk about how easy it is for COVID-19 to be transferred inside because of how close the cells are to each other. Yeah. Can you describe what it looks like inside and why COVID-19 would spread so fast among the population?
Definitely, definitely. So originally the prison was built with five tiers, I think 400 cells total, and they were meant for one person. Recently, they added another bunk inside of a 5x10 cell. You can hardly pass, but you can't walk in the cell. Two people can't be, you know, on the floor in the cell at the same time and pass each other. It's impossible. It's a cramped space. Even if you slept head to foot, you know, you're still in this cell, in this tight quarters, such tight quarters, it doesn't matter which way you sleep. And so there's that. And then once you step outside onto the tier is 3 feet wide. And so that's also impossible. It's also impossible to pass somebody on this tier. So then there's open bars. And not the good kind, like at a good wedding, like open bars, like you can grab them. And there's just, you can breathe. There's poor ventilation, if any, inside. And so once they're released or you know, you go pick up your meal. I know there's been reports saying that they're going to be self-fed, but those rules are rarely adhered to. I mean, it would take 2 to 4 officers, I don't know how many hours, to feed a whole building. And so what usually happens is they'll release a whole side of a tier at one time, and those 50 or 60 people will shuffle down a crowded tier to go get a very terrible meal, which is partly why, you know, they're doing the hunger strike in the first place, to bring attention to these horrible conditions, these horrible meals. Yeah, what else is pertinent to the design? Yeah, just the fact that building is just about close to 200% capacity. So that's another thing. When you want to socially distance, it's just impossible, no matter how you slice it, no matter what type of shell game you try to play and move people here and shift them there. Actually, when they do that, it's just making things worse.
And talk about what you know about what the demands are in terms of the hunger strike taking place in San Quentin right now.
They want to stop transfers. They want to have mass releases. That's definitely two of the main ones that I see being the only ways to stop this spread is to do the mass releases, stop the transfers. Because, you know, the way that, you know, I watched that Senate public hearing and I heard a bunch of, you know, I know we're FCC regulations here, a lot of horse manure about what's really happening inside the prison. And so when they say that we're doing these transfers, we're doing this testing, we're doing all this proper placement, and no, that's not the way it's working. You have, you know, the head of the CDCR saying one thing, and then on the ground, it's implemented completely wrong. You know, when it comes to a transfer, let's just take the Chino transfer to San Quentin. When these people were tested, they were released back into the general population to mingle in this general population that is the scene of a massive outbreak. And so whether they were put back in the general population for 2 weeks, for 2 days, for 20 minutes, like the possibility for them to get infected is high, and for them to bring that to San Quentin also high. So yeah, it's a pretty foul situation all the way around, especially the way that CDCR's response to it. And the meeting of the demands, like the demand for the releases, that's been tiny drops in the buckets. You know, they released 3,500, I think 2 months ago. They're looking to release another 3,500. That's only a small percentage of the population, and it's not going to make a dent. And there's so many restrictions on who they want to release and why. And, you know, they're not following data. They're following headlines when they decide who they want to release. And that's also wrong. I mean, the safest people to release are lifers, and they refuse to do that because of their crimes. I've seen the question, like, well, what do we do with the murderers? Well, what you do is you let them out and you let them live their life the way that I have. I mean, I don't usually try to talk about my crime, but I was convicted of 2 second-degree murders. I did decades. I did a whole lot to come home, and I'm here. And so for those people that, what about, look at me, like that's, I mean, and I'm not the only one that's, you know, doing the same thing that I'm doing. There's so many lifers that come home, do great in the community and make a difference and become assets. We've turned our lives around, and our recidivism rate, I think it used to be under less than 1%. I think just based on the number of lifers that have come home, it's risen, I think, to under 3%. But still, considering the general statewide recidivism rate for non-lifers being around 60%, that's just not, you're not working with data. You're working with headlines, like I said, when you're considering these releases. So I said there's so many things that can be done as far as releasing lifers, expanding commutations. there's a whole lot. Clemency process from the governor. There's also some recent stuff that I've heard from lawyers that have been looking up different ways, and there's even ways for wardens to let people out from what I hear. I definitely need to do another story and definitely need to do some more research on that myself. But there's a lot of mechanisms in place within the system to release, but they're just scared. And I think, you know, when you put politics over people, that's not the way to lead.
That was Philip Melendez speaking with Kat Brooks. Stay with us. We'll be back after this short break. COVID cases are also on the rise at immigration detention centers. Immigration Customs Enforcement, or ICE, has reported over 2,700 confirmed cases of COVID-19 at their facilities. Anthony Alexander is being held at the Otay Mesa Detention Facility outside of San Diego, California. He spoke with Upfront's Brian Edwards Teeker about what it's like right now in an ICE detention center and the concerns asylum seekers have about COVID-19.
Describe the place that you live right now.
Well, first, let me start by saying I'm indignant as a human being to have witnessed the level of negligence they exhibited. Their behavior echoes, since we are on the verge of being deported, we're just going to profit of your suffering and ignore our basic dignity, and no one will care. So what they do here, it's basically telling us that, you know, it doesn't matter what's going to happen. Civil detention and with cramped, unsanitary, lack of oversight, poor ventilation amid COVID-19 violates our due process right to protection from harm and to be free from punitive condition. So we started a hunger strike because we were protesting the unsafe condition in here. So they decided to pepper spray us, okay, because we wanted to protest. And what they did was they took us from our pod, which was 40 of us we were in L pod. They took us from L pod to put us on M pod, which had tested 15 people were tested 5 positive at M pod. So they're basically putting people that are not tested positive with people that's testing positive. So our numbers dwarfed every other detention centers in the United States, and we had the first facility death, Carlos Escobar. And when we were moving from Alpine to Empire, we witnessed Carlos Escobar gasping for air. All of us witnessed that. And they took Carlos Escobar from Empire to put him on Alpine. That pod being just pepper sprayed, this was devastating. I just don't understand how they behave that way. Their attitude is so cavalier toward us. They don't care. They're just basically telling us, you know what? If you don't want to be catch the COVID-19, just sign your deportation. And I told one of the deportation officer, I said, I told him, listen, this is a violation of our due process right. He said to us, well, you know what? We're all going to die one day. This is not right. In here, we do not have any right. We cannot exhibit our, we have no right for basically. So basically, they block us from calling autonomous detention resistance. They making sure they feeding us only three times a day bologna sandwiches. On Lessex Nexus, they only cherry picked all the cases they have won. So anything that would be vital for us to win our cases, they're not putting that on LexisNexis. So this is very difficult for us. This is not the United States of America.
So my understanding is ICE publicly is saying there have been 167 COVID cases where you are in Otay Mesa, but they're now down to just three active cases. Does that jive with what you see from inside?
Absolutely not. The numbers are 250 last time I checked, and that was like a week ago. I stopped counting now. And I think it's between 250 and 260 as of today, I would say, because there was like 10 detainees that tested positive a few days ago. So last time I checked, it was 250. So it should be around 260 right now.
And like what precautions are in place to keep you from passing the virus that causes COVID-19 back and forth between people who are detained?
There's no cohesive plan whatsoever. So once they are still bringing new detainees from other detention centers, from other facilities inside here. And ACLU had won the injunction for us to be released for, especially the people that suffer from underlying conditions. And they said that they reduced the amount of detainees. Now they are bringing more. So basically, there's no possible way to adhering basic. There's no way to. We all cramp in one. We congregate in one little small area with 20 tables, and really, it's very difficult for us to adhering any social distancing. So it is impossible to be safe from a pandemic like this in a facility where you cannot even have basic dignity. So this is very difficult for us.
What about access to masks, hand soap, hand sanitizer?
There's no such thing. They don't give us hand sanitizer whatsoever. So in the beginning, they weren't giving us masks. They were giving us temporary masks that you could only wear one time. And they passed that probably, twice since I've been here. And they just recently give us those cheap cloth masks that we could wash every day. And this is not something that... there's nobody organization that go home to make sure, I wonder what I can do to make sure these detainees have been safe from COVID-19 and this facility. No one is doing that.
Have you thought about agreeing to rapid deportation so that you're not exposed to the virus in there?
Well, at some point, all of us here have been thinking something like that. I also myself was thinking about maybe I could just get out of here and just sign this deportation because the condition in here is dire. I didn't want to be here. So, I was going to do that, and then I spoke to one of the members of ACLU. She told me about this penal code that could help me, and I'm filling this paper right now as we speak to make sure that I reverse the charges because. I can be honest with you. There's no such thing as equal protection under the law for us. You in here, since you are in the verse of being deported, they don't care. It doesn't matter what's going to happen to you. We're just going to profit off your suffering and make sure that, you know, ignore basic dignity and no one will care.
Now, the guards, the staff for ICE, they're breathing the same air that you are in there, do any of them seem concerned about the conditions they're creating?
Basically, there's two CEO that had sued CoreCivic because of the condition, because the condition they put them. Because in the beginning, they didn't even want them to wear masks because they don't want them to freak us out. That's what they were saying. So we wanted to make sure that we in here and help out the part that I'm at, the part that I reside, that I wanted to make sure everybody that comes in here, they wear a mask. So this was one of the reasons why we protested, because we wanted to make sure that we didn't catch anything, because a lot of us here suffer from underlying conditions, so we had to be safe. So the guards also, they're not safe as well.
That was Anthony Alexander, an asylum seeker in ICE detention, talking to Brian Edwards Tekert, co-host of Upfront. She recently published an investigation into reports that immigrants in detention with medical vulnerabilities have been choosing deportation over living with the risk of coronavirus infection in ICE facilities. According to Goddess Dinner, many immigrants are coming to this decision with encouragement from immigration officials. She spoke about ICE's treatment of asylum seekers and the larger political landscape impacting conditions in ICE detention.
How did you get started looking at this story?
So I got a call from some immigration advocates on this side of the border. I'm based here in Mexico, on this side of the border, who had met a man, a Mexican man named Lucas, who had just returned to Mexico from from a detention center in Arizona, La Palma Correctional Center, which is a former jail that's now operating as an ICE detention center, and. You know, they said, you know, have you been deported? And he said, well, I asked for my deportation because there's dozens of coronavirus cases in the facility. And I have a severe case of diabetes. And I was very concerned about contracting COVID-19 in the facility. So I ultimately decided that it was safer for me to withdraw my asylum claims and seek my own deportation. And particularly at the stage that Lucas was at in his case, he had passed his credible fear interview, which is one of the first steps in seeking asylum. And he hadn't received any sort of negative ruling in his case. So to withdraw your asylum claim at that stage, according to lawyers and advocates that I spoke to, is relatively rare. So I got a call from some of these immigration advocates who said, you know, Lucas is really interested in speaking to a reporter about his experiences in La Palma and how he feels that it inhibited him from being able to pursue his asylum claims. And so I spoke to Lucas, and from there I started to speak to current and former detainees, as well as immigration advocates and lawyers all over the country.
So the things that Anthony Alexander was just describing at Otay Mesa, poorly controlled transfers of infected prisoners from one pod to another, or non-infected prisoners to a pod where there is infection, very late issuance of masks that are kind of substandard, poor access to soap and hand sanitizer. How common is that at other facilities?
So I spoke to about 15 people who are either current or recently detained, as well as, you know, a few dozen immigration advocates, and lawyers working all over the country. And I would say, you know, many are citing these types of concerns about people's health and about the conditions that exist in place to, you know, limit the spread of COVID-19. Interestingly, a recent Inspector General report from DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, which is the parent agency of ICE, also cited some concerns after a survey of the majority, about 188 detention facilities across the country. And it echoed some of the concerns that current and former detainees had raised while, you know, saying sort of other issues. So one thing, for example, Anthony mentioned that he hadn't had any access, or he or others hadn't had any access to hand sanitizer. According to the Inspector General report, about a third of all ICE detention facilities reported not having enough hand sanitizer for detainees. So it's not only people who are detained and their advocates who are raising some concerns. It's also, you know, the Inspector General of DHS itself are pointing to some of the very serious challenges, which, you know, ICE as an agency itself has raised about limiting the spread of a major historic pandemic inside detention centers, which, you know, by their nature are communal spaces. And so they are the types of places in which, in the words of many detention centers responding to the surveys, you know, the detention centers themselves said that social distancing is a challenge.
Is there any evidence that the neglect is at least in part intentional to help get people to do exactly what some of them are doing, hasten their own deportation?
You know, as a reporter, I certainly don't have any evidence that there is a top-down directive from DHS or from ICE in order to use the virus to compel people to withdraw their asylum claims or their other immigration claims. The idea that the conditions within detention centers have long propelled some people to withdraw their claims is certainly something that immigration advocates and lawyers and detainees themselves have been raising concerns about for quite some time, including before the pandemic. So certainly even before the pandemic, you know, ICE detention was not a five-star hotel. And so for quite some time, immigration advocates and lawyers have been raising questions and concerns about why asylum seekers and others have to remain in prison-like facilities while they pursue their claims, and whether even before a pandemic, that is limiting some people's ability to, as Anthony mentioned, receive due process and pursue their claims. That's something that has been raised since the pandemic, certainly more, because obviously people who are detained inside in communal settings are by nature more susceptible to contracting COVID-19. But this has certainly been a cause for concern by immigration advocates even before the pandemic.
You did document multiple instances where when detainees raised health concerns with their guards, the guards basically said, well, you can always leave the country if you want.
Yeah, so it was a very reoccurring concern that current and former detainees told me about, which was essentially that when they, you know, whether it was a protest or whether they, in the case of Anthony and others, or whether it was just somebody saying, you know, I have an underlying condition and I'm very concerned about my health, that often allegedly the response by either contractors, you mentioned CoreCivic, there's also Geo Group, obviously, which is another private prison contracting company, or whether it's ICE officials themselves responding, essentially saying, you know, if you don't want to contract COVID-19, you can always sign for your deportation to get out of detention. I spoke to a spokesperson from ICE who said that the agency has no policy to encourage detainees to drop their asylum claims in order to protect themselves against COVID-19, and that they take all concerns about alleged comments like this very seriously. So, you know, that's the agency's position. At the same time, certainly almost all of the detainees I spoke to cited hearing some type of comment to this effect.
So it's not like ICE only has two choices, detain people or deport people. In the circumstances you described just a few minutes ago, someone who's passed their credible fear interview, which means they are a likely candidate for asylum, it would be perfectly normal in a prior era for them to be released and given temporary working papers in the United States while the rest of the process worked its way out. Can you talk about how the Trump administration's changes to how it handles asylum seekers have increased the number of people and the amount of risk in these facilities?
I think that's a very good point. Thanks for raising that. Certainly, once one is presented with a system, then it seems like there's only two choices. But yes, I think you've raised a very good point, which is that the United States is now detaining more asylum seekers and immigrants than in previous periods. And certainly now, in the midst of COVID, the detention numbers are down. But you know, under the Trump administration overall, we've seen a large expansion of the number of people who are going through their asylum claims, who are spending that time months, if not years. I spoke to people who had been detained for well over a year, spending that entire time in detention rather than being released. And certainly we heard earlier Anthony saying that he and others are asking for their release. And he mentioned that there's ankle monitors and there's other types of monitoring systems that the U.S. government uses when it releases people. ICE has released a number of people in the midst of the pandemic. But, you know, when you speak to immigration lawyers and advocates, they mention that, you know, they've, in the case of Lucas, for example, you know, his lawyer had been filing numerous applications for humanitarian parole. A number of other people have filed for discretionary release. And so what immigration lawyers are saying is that there are still many people who are inside ICE facilities who could be eligible for release, but that ICE is holding them. ICE, when I spoke to them, says that, you know, they evaluate every single case and they evaluate previous criminal history, potential issues of flight risk when deciding whether to grant people discretionary release or not. But, you know, according to a recent lawsuit, even ICE acknowledges that there are approximately 4,000 people with underlying conditions that make them particularly vulnerable to complications from COVID-19 who are still in ICE detention centers. It's not known how many of them. It is known at least over 1,000 of them, I understand, according to the filing, are not subject to mandatory detention, which means they could be released under ICE discretion.
You were listening to Laura Gottesdiener being interviewed by Brian Edwards Tekert. Keep listening. We'll be back after a short break. On July 4th, community organizers received permission to paint a large temporary mural of the words Black Lives Matter in the street in front of the county courthouse in Martinez, California, a small suburban city on the edge of the San Francisco Bay Area. It took more than 100 community members around 7 hours to paint the mural, but less than an hour after it was completed, two Martinez residents defaced the piece, dumping a bucket of black paint on the bright yellow letters and painting over the work with a paint roller. Onlookers recorded the two vandals, who said that all lives matter, racism is a lie, and that the Black Lives Matter movement was not welcome in Martinez.
I said no one wants Black Lives Matter here, that's what I said.
Oh, really?
All lives matter. Huh? Yeah,
well,
okay. You want to drink my face? Keep America great again, that's right. Why don't you guys learn about history? The Emancipation Proclamation Act.
History,
That's right. Abraham Lincoln. You're only free because of our forefathers. You know what? All lives matter, dude. I ain't f***ing down for this bullshit.
Black lives matter, no lives matter.
Yeah, all lives matter. All lives matter, that's right. You know what? The only reason why you're crying, why people cry police brutality, people are resisting arrest. Don't have a run-in with the law and don't resist arrest. It won't be a problem.
Those two individuals have since been charged with a misdemeanor hate crime, as well as two other vandalism misdemeanors. In a separate incident on Sunday, a man was arrested for allegedly brandishing a loaded gun after getting into an argument with people at the mural site after he drove past them and shouted, "All Lives Matter." Davey D is the host of KPFA's Hard Knock Radio. He spoke to Justin Gomez, one of the mural's organizers, and Nikenya Allen, a local activist. They talked about the events surrounding the mural and the conversations taking place about race and racism in smaller suburban communities.
Justin, I've seen you on the news. You've been talking to a lot of people. You're the muralist for Black Lives Matter. Tell us what you know and see and how you're feeling.
Yeah, so I definitely can't take credit for the entire mural. It was inspired by the murals we've seen across the country, and it was over 100 community members that came together to paint that on Saturday. So in a nutshell, what happened is we had spent 7 hours on Saturday painting it. Less than an hour after its completion, that now viral video, that incident occurred, and those two individuals defaced our artwork, and it was very disheartening.
What happened? Because that area was kind of empty when we see the video. You all did the mural, had all the fanfare, and left, and then they showed up and then just tried to deface it or what?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. So the mural was completed about 2 p.m. I left there as the organizer about 2:30. There were folks present just enjoying it. And then a half hour later, I got a tag in a social media post in that now viral video. So I went down there. I posted on social media immediately that the mural's been vandalized. This is the video. And I got down there. And in the span of me posting that and the 5 minutes it takes me to get downtown, there were already community members who had been there to paint it, ready to fix it. And I gave them the paint. So it was vandalized less than an hour after it was completed, but we fixed it within less than an hour after it had been vandalized. So it's currently still intact, and it looks great downtown.
You said dozens of people participated in the mural. When you were putting this together, was there hostility directed at you or any of the artists? Were people in the wings saying things? Was this something you anticipated to happen?
Absolutely. It happened in downtown Martinez, which on the 4th of July is a pretty busy area. And we had the street shut down, and Court Street is a main thoroughfare. So there were a lot of vehicles driving by, and we had a lot of All Lives Matter, a lot of, profanities and things being hurled at us. People, not understanding of the movement, not supportive of the artwork, definitely letting us know that, but we fully expected that.
Nikenya, how long have you been out in Martinez, and what's been your experience with the climate there? I think many people listening are like, I don't know Martinez had that sort of hostility. What's going on there?
I have been a resident of Martinez for the last 12 years. To be honest, when I did not really hang out there until I became a parent. For the most part, I went to school by day, worked overnights. So I was barely there. I just kind of enjoyed it, sort of. But, now that I'm a mother and I'm spending a lot of time in the environment and, trying to find parenting groups, I have noticed that there are a lot of people in that town that are just not up to snuff when it comes to diversity. They're not culturized. And they are comfortable there. It's just one of the many towns in America where when you don't have a lot of people of color, when you don't have a lot of, they have no motivation. They have nothing really pushing them to be any better. Mm-hmm. That literally becomes a place that is comfortable for white nationalists. And I wouldn't, Justin is the activist in the area. I would call myself more of a budding activist. And with this, I'm not even going to call the Black Lives Matter movement a protest. To me, it's an uprising.
Right.
And everybody, just no matter where you are in the world, you know, and in America as a Black person, your hands are on deck. So I've been waiting for a while. I do befriend the person who is in charge of the Together We Stand group. A few weeks ago was when I really started pushing for the protest because white nationalist recruitment flyers posted. I think I sent you one.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. You know, for people that's listening, that's the voice of Nakenya Allen. We also have Justin Gomez talking about what's going on in Martinez. The headline story has been the mural, the defacing, the confrontation, the two individuals that came, and then somebody showing up with a gun. But what didn't necessarily get covered, even locally, was the recruitment. You know, the white pride flyers that were going out. And so this is the backdrop in which some of this is existing. So talk a little bit about these recruitment flyers. That was mind-boggling.
Yeah, and it was definitely on the hush because when I found out about them, I was livid, you know, because again, we're already in the middle of an uprising. And one of the things that I noticed with everything that was going on, I was like, where's the white nationalist? You know, like, they're here, but where are they? And of course, they're like in my backyard. But I mean, and then that flyer comes up. And then, you know, that flyer, I believe, came up after our last protest. Out of all the cities across the Bay, I believe that Martinez was like the most humble when it came to the Black Lives Matter protest. I think we've only really had two. And they were really great. And I did notice there was not a lot of, as far as the city is concerned, it was a small fraction of the community who was there. And I noticed that right off the bat. And I was like, oh, okay. And those flyers did pop up and they got buried really quickly.
What did the flyers say?
They had a lot of profanity in them. I'm going to pull it up and try to see if I can give you a little overview without using what they said. But for the most part, it was titled Black Lives Matter. And then it went on to use a lot of white nationalist talking points that we hear a lot, but we don't just call it what it is, you know, talking about how Black Lives Matter is just like a hate group and how we're just out to take over white people. It definitely has a feel to it of appealing to some white person who is scared. And
right.
It's like, and then it's and it starts asking questions. We're, you know, after it says we are the chosen people, who are going to protect us, who are going to do. And so it's basically a call, like a dog.
Right.
So, like,
so the man that was in the video, he seemed to have those talking points down, you know, that were in the flyer. One would wonder if he was the one who put the flyer out, you know.
I believe that they are collectively on the same page. And I don't think that it matters which one you talk to. This is how they were raised. This is who they are. So they're all pretty much a collective when it comes to where they stand in solidarity. And I say they because there is an us and there is a them, you know, just all.
Justin Gomez, Nakenya said you're the activist in the area. What's been the challenges that you've seen understanding how the Bay has gotten down? I mean, this is when activities happen here, they've always been transformative, from the Oscar Grant movement to the Occupy Wall Street / Occupy Oakland movement, yeah, to the environmental justice, climate change. There's always a very spirited and impactful approach,
yeah,
towards social justice. So you kind of know the get down here. So seeing,
yeah,
that, what has it been like for you as an activist in Martinez?
Yeah, I think I myself often struggle with being called an activist and an organizer, but I think like Nakenya, I'm simply a parent of a biracial family in a predominantly white community. And I see the the movement that is happening in, you know, Berkeley, Oakland, San Francisco. And I think oftentimes when we're having these conversations in our smaller, more suburban towns, people think it's not our problem. People think racism doesn't live here. They think it's a big city issue. One of the things that the woman says in that video is, you know, keep this in New York. Black Lives Matter doesn't belong in her town. So I think oftentimes for people who are kind of in the middle of the road and they're not engaged on one side or the other, they think that they get a pass. And I think we're here to say we do not get a pass. Martinez does not get a pass. This is a dialogue that we need to engage in. Even though we only have less than 4% members of our community who identify as Black or African American, we need to stand up for them. We need to mobilize. We need to show up. And beyond protests in the street and murals on pavement, what we really need to do in true solidarity with the BLM movement is to advocate for policy change, is to defund the Martinez Police Department. So in addition to, you know, the mobilizations we've had, we're also showing up at our city council meetings. At the next city council meeting, there's going to be an agenda item for the forming of an anti-racist subcommittee of the city council, because we need to see structural change. We can make those calls for action in the street, but we need to see policy on paper at City Hall.
Are you satisfied, either you, Justin, or Nakenya, are you satisfied with the city's response, one, to the flyers that came out? And, you know, two, I guess we're waiting to see what will be their response to the national attention that is, you know, Martinez is now garnered because of the defacing of the black mural thing. So let me start off with you, Justin. Are you satisfied? And we'll go to you, Nakenya.
Absolutely not. I perceive our entire city council as white. They are all white or white passing. And it has been like pulling teeth to get a timely proportional response from most of them. I will say one council member, Norley Giffner, was the first one to come out and say Black Lives Matter after the murder of George Floyd. But our mayor Rob Schroeder, is dragging his feet constantly. When we live in a time where you can tweet or you can post on social media or you have a platform like Facebook and you can release a timely statement directly to your community through official channels, like, we're not asking for you to send us all a letter in the mail. Like, we want you to say something on the internet directly to the community. We want you to say Black Lives Matter. We want you to condemn racism when it surfaces. The response for the white supremacist flyer, the flyer was found on Saturday evening. News broke of it at 6 a.m. Sunday morning. We did not see an official response from our city, our mayor, until late Tuesday morning.
Wow.
So I think when racism surfaces, we need to confront it immediately, and for our leadership to let, you know, days elapse before they want to speak out in a capacity. And oftentimes the statements are very placating. They're very politically safe. It's just not what the movement needs right now. And I think when you see the leadership in larger cities taking swift, divisive action, you know, like large municipalities like Minneapolis or Chicago or San Francisco, you know, looking at London Breed's leadership, just because we're a small town doesn't mean that type of bold leadership can't occur here. Right. And that's what we want to see.
You meant to say decisive, not divisive.
Yeah, sorry.
I mean, because some people, you know, some of the leadership, you know, we might say it's divisive.
Yeah. And I think, you know, when we're talking about Martinez getting a pass, when our leadership doesn't show up, some people, that's why people think we get a pass, because nobody is leading. A call I made to the city council is, you know, leadership isn't just a position. It's not a rank. Leadership is a choice. So they need to choose to show up in this moment. And if they do, the community will follow.
You were listening to Justin Gomez and Nakenya Allen speaking to Hard Knock Radio's Davey D. This concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates that contributed to the production of this show. I'm Scott Baba. Thanks for listening.
This has been COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily broadcast by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates, produced by a group of committed men and women volunteers willing to make a difference. If you tuned in late, you can listen and download the show from our YouTube channel, Pacifica Foundation TV, or from the website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. tell a friend about it. It will be worth it.